From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Security questions continue to swirl around Georgia's electoral process. Lawmakers largely agree that the state's current touchscreen voting machines have to go. They don't leave a paper trail, and a number of analysts worry that they could be hacked. The question isn't whether the machines need to be replaced, but how. The Secretary of State's office has created a commission to answer that question. GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler was at that group's meeting this week, is in the studio now with us. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning.
Also here, Political Rewind host Bill Nygut. We're going to discuss how lawmakers might act on this issue. Bill, always great to have you with us.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Well, I'm going to start with you. Before Stephen talks us through possible solutions that the commission's been discussing this week, could you help us understand the problem? Just how out of date are Georgia's voting machines, and what does that mean?
Well, they're so out of date that they use a version of Microsoft's operating system that Microsoft no longer supports, which is never a good thing.
Yeah.
They're terribly out of date. There's significant concerns, as you've already pointed out, about their reliability, even without regard to the potential for hacking of the machines. So even before this election cycle began, in which the notion of voter suppression and other issues that some claim surrounded how the election was run by the Secretary of State's office, even before that, it was clear that legislators were going to have to start thinking about paying for new machines, which is why Brian Kemp put a commission in place well before the election cycle began.
And Stephen, you've been at this Secure, Accessible, and Fair Elections Commission meeting, SAFE for short. Who's on the commission and how did it come into being?
Well, so the commission is a bipartisan commission that, like Bill said, former Secretary of State, now Governor-elect Brian Kemp put together. The current co-chairs are Interim Secretary of State Robin Crittenden and Representative Barry Fleming. And so you have two House members, two Senate members, two Republicans, two Democrats, and you have different county elections officials from across the state, large and small. You've got representatives of the political parties there and some experts on things like cybersecurity and accessibility. So altogether, they are this commission tasked with kind of vetting the future of Georgia's voting machines and voting systems.
Now, Bill, you've spoken with lawmakers about the issue. Do you get a sense that this commission is going to go anywhere? I mean, are lawmakers serious about addressing this before 2020?
Absolutely. This is the new voting is going to be put in place, new ways of voting. Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, a real veteran of the legislature, was on Political Rewind yesterday. She's a key member of the Government Operations Committee, which is going to have something to say about all this. And she made it clear to us that there's no question that Democrats and Republicans alike want to do something. The key question is, what kind of voting will we go to? And that was something that certainly came up when Stephen was down at the SAFE Commission meeting yesterday.
What did you hear, Stephen?
Well, so the commission has, this is their third meeting. The last one they had was canceled when the hurricane came through, and they're going to have one more meeting in January before they make their official recommendations and vote on them. So they've been hearing presentations from different people, different groups, different vendors. Yesterday morning opened with a presentation about restoring trust in the voting system, and Garland Favorito was with a group called Voter GA, and he gave a presentation about all of the different ways people don't trust the system, different problems that have been having. He showed things about lost votes or votes not counting or votes you touch the machine for one candidate and it goes to the other, and kind of walked the commission through all of the problems that have been faced in the 16 years Georgia's been using the current system and why people don't necessarily trust the system to accurately reflect their vote and count it. And so he also made suggestions on how to improve it. You know, Georgia's next election system should do this, it should do that, it should have this. And these are ways that people could maybe have a little bit more faith and prove that the voting does count when they go on election day.
I'm trying to think of the machines, the computer I was using 16 years ago, and it's a little hard to imagine. Okay, but capitalizing on that, Bill, the Secretary of State, as you said, Brian Kemp, then Secretary of State, launched this election commission. So does he need to fortify trust in the electoral process, or is this about his own political capital?
No, I think that that the governor-elect, in fact, we're hearing, may very well support some legislation that would improve how we run elections in the state, that would reform some of the problems we've had in the past. We don't know for a fact that he's going to do that, but I think that he very well may, we're being told. Now, the key question that we're going to run into, and Stephen certainly saw this play out a little bit yesterday, is there is a contingent. The commission has a cybersecurity expert from Georgia Tech who's part of the organization. He is recommending that we need to go to handwritten ballots. You know, you fill out a little bubble and then feed it to an optical reader. He believes that's crucial because it would absolutely eliminate, he says, the possibility of in any
hacking,
way.
Right?
Yeah, any kind of hacking. So are we going to go to that kind of system? Or, as incoming Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger has said repeatedly, are we just going to find a new kind of machine, computerized voting machine, that will leave a paper trail? And I do think there's going to be debate about those two basic concepts of how we will cast ballots in the future.
Well, I'm guessing there is something in between there, paper ballots and also computers that leave a paper trail. But Stephen, what are the next steps for this commission? I mean, how do we even get a new voting system?
Well, so there have been seven different vendors that have submitted different ideas and forms of replacing the voting system. And the voting system is not just the machines. There's the machines we cast the votes, but then there's also the voter registration database that's used to say, okay, here's your ballot, here's who you're supposed to be voting for. There's also the election night reporting system where, you know, you've got to get the votes counted and uploaded and put somewhere. So that's part of the system. So there's a lot of different options, and this group has seen them, they've tested them, they've watched different presentations. So they're going to put together recommendations with the Secretary of State's office on what all to do with the election system and how things would be changed. Another thing that was brought up yesterday is that the state's election code is going to have to be changed. It's not just buying a new machine and plugging it in and going. You know, there's different mechanisms for counting ballots, for challenging ballots, for mail-in ballots and things. And so there's a pretty substantial legislative overhaul that's going to happen. But that's going to depend on what system is selected. So like Bill was saying, there are really two main camps of potential systems. One is hand-marked paper ballots that are scanned by some sort
optical
of optical
reader,
scanner,
yeah.
Or there's something called ballot marking devices, which is that kind of middle ground that you were talking about, where you go to some sort of machine and make your votes, and it will print out a piece of paper. Now, the piece of paper could have a barcode that is then scanned. It could have a barcode with your votes printed out underneath it, so you can look and say, yes, I did vote for George Washington for president. Or, you know, there's a bunch of different options that have their own pros and cons. So it's really going to be up to this group to figure out the best recommendations and then how to change all of the different parts and pieces and laws.
You know, it's going to be yesterday on our show, Mary Margaret Oliver said, we got to get moving on this now. I mean, 2020 is closer than you think, and she's right. You not only have to decide what you're going to use to vote on. By the way, the feds will pay a good portion mm-hmm. of the cost of all
I
this.
I want to get the cost.
But the other reason you've got to get going now is not just to acquire the machines. I remember very clearly when Georgia switched to computerized voting machines, there was an enormous public education program that had to be put in place mm-hmm. so that all of us understood exactly how we voted on the machines. I remember being a reporter called to a meeting with then Secretary of State Kathy Cox, in which she demonstrated one of these machines and asked us if we would be willing to work with her to do stories that showed people how to do it. And of course, because it was a public service, we said yes. But the next Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, is going to have to launch a similar education effort. So it is not too early to make this happen.
Well, let's talk about paying for them. At one point, the Secretary of State's office threw out a rough estimate of $100 million to provide Georgia polling places with mm-hmm. a certain type of new machines. So how does the federal government, they are going to be helping to pay for it. Where does that money come from, and how much will Georgia be on the hook for?
We don't know exactly the cost yet. We can say this. Number one, the feds will most likely pay for the majority of the costs of the machines because it's in the federal government does, in fact, budget money for state election processes. That's another thing that people who support the hand-marked ballot say is a reason to go to it. It is by far the cheapest way to vote. And I can't remember, I think I saw a cost of about $30 million to go to paper balloting as opposed to several hundred million for new machines.
Well, and some of the cost with the machines, you have an upfront cost. You have to buy the machines, you have to do the training, you have to educate people and everything. But the hand-marked paper ballot camp, it's cheaper upfront because you would just have to buy on-demand ballot printers to have in different counties and locations. And so you don't have to print off, okay, I'm going to assume I need 10 million. Million ballots, you print off enough, and then as people come in, there's these printers that can print the ballots safely and securely at the location. So the cost is cheaper up front, but then more later. And the big piece of that, too, will be the education budget. The commission yesterday said that definitely there needs to be some sort of budget in to educate voters, especially if it's something different like paper ballots, which is not what people have been used to for the past 16 years.
So after this commission makes its recommendation, of course, it goes to the legislature. But if it costs that much money, is legislative action needed to fund this specifically? Or is this something that, for example, Governor-elect Kemp could stick into the budget? Or does it have to be hashed out?
No, legislators will have to approve the budget. They'll have to find room for it in the budget. You know, those legislators, they want to have something to say about how the state spends its money.
Well, but you said there are two camps of on the methodology. How about camps on, we're not going to spend this money? Have you been hearing that from any of the legislators?
Well, you know, I talked to State Senator Brian Strickland, who is in the Senate. He's a Republican from McDonough, and he's one of Governor-elect Kemp's floor leaders who will be helping shepherd the legislation. And he said that there won't be any sort of issues in the legislature convincing people something needs to change, but there's going to be the debate about how to change because the Democrats may have one idea, Republicans may have one idea, people who don't want to spend a lot of money on it may have another idea. So it's going to take some more conversations and massaging through the legislature. This is not something that's going to be passed day one of the legislature. Boom, we're finished, we're done, move on to the next thing.
Well, of course, the courts are also involved with this. Our new governor and state lawmakers have been embroiled in this. Can you give us an update on the various lawsuits over election security?
So, fun fact, yesterday at the commission meeting, the general counsel for the Secretary of State's office gave a brief overview of some of the litigation, and it was really brief because many of the people who are suing the state were also in that room watching. So, the general counsel didn't want to give too many details about their defense or give too many details about it because some of the people they were going up against were in the room. But there's still the Curling v. Kemp paper ballots lawsuit that kind of started off a lot of the litigation trying to force Georgia to move to hand-marked paper ballots. That's currently in an appeal in federal court. And so if that appeal is unsuccessful or successful, you know, it could go back to Judge Totenberg and she could have more decisions to make in kind of forcing Georgia's hand with how the election system are changed. Another lawsuit is filed by the Coalition for Good Governance, an outside group, trying to get a redo of the lieutenant governor's election because there were about 100,000 or so less votes in that election than any other statewide race. And that has to do with the touchscreen machines and allegations that it didn't register. So there's plenty of other lawsuits that popped up here and there about absentee ballots and other things. And so, you know, there's a lot of lawsuits. There's a lot of things that are going to be resolved either by the courts or by a new system.
All right. I'm guessing that we might start seeing our candidates for 2020 before we start seeing these machines. I want to thank you both so much for your help.
Thanks, Virginia.
Thanks
for coming in. GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler and Political Rewind host Bill Nygut. Coming up, you weren't dreaming if you felt the earth move early yesterday morning. Can Georgia expect more earthquakes? We're going to ask some people who know when On Second Thought returns. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A 4.4 magnitude earthquake hit Tennessee just after 4 a.m. on Wednesday morning. Seismic tremors shook some Georgians awake in the wee hours and were reported as far south as LaGrange. That got us wondering about Georgia's tectonic plates. Joining me with some things we might have missed in geology class is Jim Reichart. He's professor and chair of geology at Georgia Southern University, and he's joining us on the line from Statesboro. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Glenn Ricks is in the studio. For those of us who never studied civil engineering, let's say, senior principal with Geosyntec Consultants. And Glenn, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
So, Jim, put this quake into perspective for us. How serious is a 4.4 magnitude quake?
It's not a serious quake in the sense that it would cause damage, but it got our attention. And in this part of the country, we don't experience earthquakes very frequently, so it naturally is something that we would talk about like this morning. If we were in California, they would probably laugh at us for talking about a quake of this magnitude.
Glenn, how about that? Did people or infrastructure closer to the epicenter suffer damage?
Not that I know of. I monitored news reports yesterday, and I'm not aware of any damage to any infrastructure. And we wouldn't expect that from a magnitude 4.4 earthquake.
But Atlanta is more than 100 miles away from Decatur, Tennessee, which is roughly the epicenter. Was it more intense in other places, in North Georgia, for example, Jim?
I'm not aware of that, but earthquake damage does depend on subsurface conditions, the type of material you're on, and, of course, the distance away. So sometimes we see damage in isolated areas, for example, on sediment that can liquefy, and adjacent to that, we see no damage. So it depends, but I wasn't aware of any reports in Georgia.
Okay, so remind us, what is actually going on in an earthquake? Yes, the tectonic plates are shifting, but what makes that happen?
Well, basically, an earthquake is rocks store up energy. Scientists refer to it as elastic energy, and they absorb and store this energy, and then when they can't hold it back any longer, they what we say rupture, and then this energy is released as vibrational waves. Then those waves travel outwards in all directions, and they are carried through the rocks. The more energy that's stored up initially, the larger the vibrational waves, and the further they travel.
So when we do think of earthquakes in the U.S., we think the coastal Northwest or California. Mm-hmm. I remember reading that article, Catherine Schultz in The New Yorker, about 5 or 10 years ago, that just put the fear of God in everybody that, the Northwest is just going to fall off the edge. How rare are earthquakes on this side of the country?
Well, actually, we have them frequently. They're just small, very small stuff that we typically measure is just instruments. And occasionally we get a very large one. For example, we had a very large magnitude 8 quake in 1811 in Missouri. We had a very large earthquake in 1886 in Charleston, South Carolina, magnitude 7.3. For the most part, we see them in the range of 3 to 4 and occasional higher. But in California, I guess it's important for your listeners to understand that California, as a lot of people know, is on a tectonic plate boundary. Two massive plates are grinding against each other where huge amounts of energy are stored and released, and so they have frequent earthquakes, and they're very large. Where we're at, we are not on a tectonic plate boundary. What's happening in the east is that there is a old inactive plate boundary associated with the Appalachian Mountains that formed over 200 million years ago. And so we have now are these old faults that are buried buried beneath the surface that sometimes will release stored energy, and we can occasionally have sometimes a large quake, but generally small. So we're not on an active plate boundary is the basic reason. But we can still have large quakes.
But if an On Second Thought listener right now is in Rabun County or in Atlanta or Southwest Georgia, so what's happening beneath our feet? Give us an idea of what kind of tectonic plates or fault lines make up the Earth on which we walk and drive all the time.
Well, the entire Earth is broken up into about 12 major tectonic plates. And it's at those boundaries where the plates meet is where most of the energy is accumulated. We are, I guess it's kind of good to think of it as a plate is like a car. There's a front end and a back end, and in the front end where the collision occurs is where most of the energy and earthquakes occur. You can think of us in the kind of middle of the back seat. We're not either at the front or the back, but there's still stresses that go throughout the whole car that can accumulate and cause faults that run through beneath Georgia to store and release energy.
Jennifer McLean from Athens left us a voicemail. She said that she'd been through a couple of earthquakes before this one.
And I felt this shake. The wall shook and the floor started shaking and the bed moved a little. And at first I thought maybe it was a helicopter landing at the hospital next door because sometimes those shake, but there was no noise. It was eerily quiet. There was no noise that came with it.
So, Glenn, when you hear things like that, you're the engineer. You're thinking about how structures are built. What's going on inside of a structure when that happens?
Yeah, so the most dangerous kind of shaking during an earthquake is that occurs horizontally, right? Structures are designed to withstand vertical loads because that's the direction that gravity imposes on them. But an earthquake opposes a horizontal force, and it's often the ability of a structure to withstand those horizontal forces that determines how it performs during an earthquake.
Is that something you think about here in Georgia?
A lot, yeah. We have building codes that try to build earthquake-resistant structures to do exactly that. And yeah, we as engineers invest a lot of time and effort in trying to make sure that our infrastructure can withstand earthquakes.
I visited City Hall in San Francisco when they were building it, and they were putting it on these giant springs. I mean, just enormous springs costing a lot of money, but you could shift 4 inches either way. 4 inches didn't seem like that much to me. Is that a lot for a building?
It is a lot, yeah. And what they're trying to do there is really isolate the building from the ground and not transmit as much of that ground shaking into the structure. So that's what those springs are trying to do.
Well, so afterwards, Jim, let me ask you, you know, after Jennifer woke up, and could there be aftershocks from this? And when do those generally happen?
Well, actually, there was a 3.3 aftershock associated with yesterday's quake. And so almost all large earthquakes have aftershocks. The larger the earthquake, the initial main shock, the higher number of aftershocks that we'll see. For example, you have a magnitude 8 quake. It's not uncommon for aftershocks to last several days, and some of them pretty large magnitude. So we did actually have an aftershock, but usually they are by definition smaller than the initial one.
So imperceptible, maybe even. Jennifer, the listener we heard from earlier, said she wasn't even sure she was feeling an earthquake.
And I thought, I must be wrong. This can't be an earthquake. It has to be a truck. And I looked out the windows, and I didn't see anything. And it was just too quiet, really. So I thought, well, I don't know what it was. And I tried to go back to sleep. But sure enough, I heard that it was an earthquake today. And just wanted to share that.
So we saw similar posts on social media. People didn't actually know that it was an earthquake or were stunned to hear it. How can you discern that you're feeling an aftershock or even an earthquake?
That for Glenn or me?
How about for you?
Well, again, keep in mind, this is a pretty small magnitude, 4.4. We begin to feel them at 3. And so for something that small magnitude, it is sometimes confusing for people. You know, you may be sleeping. It happened very suddenly, so you're not sure what's going on. But if you had a very large magnitude, like magnitude 7 or 8 that we could expect in California, that would definitely get your attention. You would have no doubt what it is very quickly.
Well, is that common here then for people to think that they mistake an earthquake for something more mundane like a big truck or a helicopter?
No, they could. For example, if you were at a construction site and there's a lot of activity and you're standing across the street, you feel vibrational waves going through the earth to you. So, yeah, people have that experience. So it can be confusing when a small quake happens. They're not quite sure what that is. It's not in their normal perception.
Well, we're getting a little bit of earthquakeology from Jim Reichart. He is a geologist, and also Glenn Ricks is with us. He is a civil engineer and counsels people on creating buildings and structures and bridges, that kind of thing, which are earthquake-proof. But I want to pick up on that activity thing, Jim. This earthquake, probably a one-off, but do you think this is part of how the earth may be changing? I mean, you know, a year ago, people said Hurricane Irma was the rare big one to hit Georgia. Then came Hurricane Michael. Does climate change have anything to do with earthquakes?
No. These are internal forces within the earth that have really nothing to do with the surface environment. Now, there is some human activity that can affect earthquake frequency. For example, we inject wastewater into deep aquifers. That has been known, and it does trigger earthquakes. Oklahoma's having a serious spike in earthquake activity associated with that. But for the most part, there's no association with what we do in the surface with earthquakes. So, and there is no uptick in earthquake frequency. This is still within normal normal frequency of quakes that we've been seeing in the past.
Well, you said injecting water. This is part of the process of fracking, correct?
Even before fracking, they disposed of oil and gas wastewater this way. Fracking has simply generated more of this wastewater, so that has been for the reason we're seeing the increase. So yes, it's mostly coming from the additional fracking water.
I was looking at some research out of the UK, but also supported by the Dutch oil and gas company about frequency of earthquakes and human-caused or human-made tremors, let's say, said they've skyrocketed in the U.S. since 2001. Is that just fracking? Is what are some other forces that could cause that?
Well, that's the induced earthquakes are from the injection of wastewater. And since there's been a huge surge in the volume of wastewater they're generating because of all the fracking activity, mm-hmm. that's the main cause of that.
Mining, anything else could influence that?
Well, for example, they had earthquakes associated with perhaps some coal mining activity where you excavate rock within the subsurface. Glenn can speak to this. And it changes the stress relationships in rocks. We can have shallow earthquakes associated with mining. That's, I don't believe, that uncommon. Glenn can speak to that.
Yeah, Glenn, pick that up.
Yeah, that's true. No, any time you do anything to change the state of stress within the Earth's surface, you create the potential for causing earthquakes. And so mining, you know, large reservoirs, anything like that that, you know, is heavy or changes the state of stress can cause earthquakes.
So how do you make an infrastructure earthquake resistant?
Yeah, you know, probably the biggest thing that we as an engineering profession have are building codes. Those are codes that tell engineers and constructors how to build buildings to make them earthquake resistant. Earlier you said earthquake proof. As an engineer, I don't like that term very much because we can't really make buildings earthquake proof. We can make them earthquake resistant. And a common misconception among the public is that building codes are intended to prevent damage to buildings. That's not the case. Building codes really try to prevent a structure from collapsing and killing or injuring people. So we're willing to trade some damage for protecting human life.
Well, can you give us some examples of projects that you're working on or maybe have worked on to make infrastructure or buildings more earthquake, let's say, resistant?
Sure, thank you. So, yes, the company that I work for, Geosyntec Consultants, all of our clients, for example, the Tennessee Valley Authority is an important client of ours. We work with their dam safety program to try to make sure that the TVA's dams are earthquake resistant. We've done a lot of work for other power utilities, trying to make sure that their waste containment facilities, in particular ash ponds, can withstand earthquakes. And I've done some work for the nuclear power sector as well, making sure that nuclear power plants can resist earthquakes as well.
So given that we don't have earthquakes very frequently in this part of the country or have not, is that a priority? You know, when you go in, rather than thinking about tornadoes or hurricanes or something like that, is that part of the mandate? We need this to be earthquake resistant? Or is that just a matter of principle? That's what you go forward with.
It is a matter of principle. It often is difficult because, you know, hurricanes are more frequent and therefore they're more on the public's mind. But an earthquake is a very damaging natural hazard, and we should always recognize the potential for a large damaging earthquake in the eastern United States.
But and if you had a job, say, in California, obviously a much different approach.
Yeah, it's more on the public's mind out there, so it's a little bit easier to convince people to spend money on mitigating for earthquake hazards, but it's no less important to do so here in the eastern United States.
How can people stay safe if they do find themselves in a much more serious earthquake or tremor than was felt the other day?
There's a lot of great guidance out there, in particular from FEMA. They have a very nice website called Earthquake Safety at Home. And in 10 words or less, their guidance is to drop, cover, and hold on. Hmm. What you don't want to do is, if you're inside, don't try to run outside. That's not a good idea, even if it seems like it at the time.
Jim, is it possible to actually predict an earthquake?
There has been a lot of research in academia in the U.S. Geological Survey on that. And there are things we call earthquake precursors. These are physical changes in properties of the rock, water levels in the subsurface. And so there's been a lot of research in California where they've been measuring these properties adjacent to known faults. And so some of these properties change right up into the rupture point. And there's been a lot of hope that we would be able to predict earthquakes based on these changing precursor activities. The problem has been that the precursors, or each earthquake is rather unique, and there's no set of precursors that reliably will predict an earthquake. And so that has been kind of the holy grail of earthquake predictions for a long time. So it's some people think we never will be able to, simply because of the complexity of the subsurface and unique nature of each one. Right. But what we can do is use past history of earthquakes. Well, we can determine when they occurred in the subsurface, and so we can, on a statistical basis, look at probabilities similar to like floods. What's the probability of a certain size flood happening in the next, 10 years or so? So we can look at statistics to get an idea of the risk and the frequency of these. But as saying when was going to earthquake occur next week at between 8 and 10 in the morning, that's not happening.
Mm-hmm. But do these factors, the things that you're talking about, taking those readings, something that is monitored or that you're monitoring here in the Southeast?
Maybe Glenn can speak to that. I don't know of anybody that's really monitoring. Our earthquakes here are so infrequent that setting up a experiment like that, they like to do it where they earthquakes occur frequently.
But there are seismic networks here throughout the eastern United States. They're less dense than they are in the western United States, but we do have a network of instruments that seeks to record earthquakes when they do occur.
So if there were a major earthquake here in Georgia, how would that affect the state? I mean, what would it look like across different parts? We have mountains, coasts, big cities. How would that look? Glenn, what's your prediction?
I think there'd be a very different response between the northern half of the state above the fault line from Columbus to Macon to Augusta. There, the ground conditions are more firm. Once you get down into the coastal plain, you create opportunities for the type of ground failure that Jim mentioned earlier, liquefaction of loose sedimentary deposits like sands and things like that.
Well, let's hope we don't see it. Glenn Rick, civil engineer and senior principal at GeoSyntech Consultants. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And Georgia Southern University geology professor Jim Reichard. Jim, thanks for your time today.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you both so much for being with us. And just ahead, Black Panther could pick up a few Golden Globes and possibly even SAG Awards. We're going to hear from an Atlanta native who was a Wakanda elder in the film and also get a little sense of what it's like to be a stand-in on set from Donald Glover's Atlanta. That's when On Second Thought continues.